Hello, welcome back to Question War, Organizing Resistance. This is Carol Bruyere, and it's May 5th. This is the I War Terror Show with Mike Palachek, and we just spoke for the first hour, so this is the second hour. And we should talk a little bit more about I War Terror, Mike. It's really a very delightful novel with some great illustrations and just very, very funny. And it does sneak in some pretty strong messages about 9/11 truth, too. And how did you come up with the idea of it, Mike?
I don't know. Maybe I suppose I was just driving. A lot of times I'm just driving along and I have an idea. You know, I don't know. Maybe you do the same thing. I get ideas when I'm driving, and I'm all of a sudden diving for pieces of paper on the floor and trying to find a pen and write them down. But a lot of times I'm just trying to fight against the world I see around me, I guess. I just see all the, it just makes me angry that we are afraid of or angry at immigrants and Muslims, and we're just so stupid. And we're just so stupid. I mean, that just pisses me. That's really what it's about, I guess. The real terrorists are George Bush and them, I'm talking about the people around here and maybe the United States collectively, we just don't understand. And I don't know. I'm just trying to tell the truth through a novel. And I wanted to tell you that. I think you said something about getting the book Beyond Bullets. You mentioned that, and I got it. And I did look at it, and it's great. They don't allow us to get the word out through the traditional media. And publishing your own books, I guess, is part of that. A person somehow has to fight against the corporate control of newspapers, and I imagine it's even in the book industry. I'm not well enough connected to know that, but it's fun to fight. You know, even as a little guy, it's fun to fight.
So are you self-published? Are those?
Well, this one is. This is the first one I've tried, and the other ones are not. But this one I didn't want to ask anybody's. I just didn't want to wait around and try and ask permission. So I asked my wife for permission. I said, I think I'm going to do this, and what do you think? And she said, well, we'll think about it. But anyway, this is self-published, 7th Street Press, and I've got a few more that I wanted to put out there. I don't know. We'll try it. The next one is about is more focused on 9/11, and my idea was to have less text that people might want be more inclined to read if there's fewer words, mm-hmm. maybe, and to have the illustrations. And the illustrations they help perhaps to sell the book, and also I think they really help to tell the story. Now that's what I'm going to try and do with my next few books.
Well, the art is great, and I know too that for me, art is so wonderful to just get the message out in ways that you just can't even do with text. I know the guy who made the Deception Dollar.
Yeah.
He originally did these beautiful satirical movie posters, and he told me, my mom thinks I shouldn't be wasting my time doing political art and I should get a job. Like, no, it's great. We need it. Do it. And I think I gave him a little bit of money just so that I could use the images on my flyers that I was passing down the street. Cause it's hard to get people to just read text. And if you have these really great pieces of art, then they'll also look at the text and the words.
Somebody handed me, I finally saw one of those in Santa Cruz on my tour. I mean, I suppose that you've been doing that for years, right? The Deception Dollar?
Yeah, and it's really helped fund the movement. But we published 7 million of them, over 7
yeah.
million.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about it. I know it got in Cost of Freedom, but you must have known somebody or somebody must have sent one to the publisher. You said it was on page 36, right? Deception
yeah.
Dollar?
There's an image of one, but it's also with other. It's in a collage. Actually, what I really like about, I mean, people, it's easy to give them away. It's a lot of fun to give them away. And there's a cottage industry where people actually sell them. Even bookstores in Amherst will sell them for 50 cents or so each. And there's a woman in Cuba, and she'll varnish them on a piece of wood, and she'll sell them for like $5 each. But a lot of people have used them in videos, and they've like plastered cars with them and built pyramids, and it's been a catalyst for other art projects, and
it's a
and
great
people
idea.
Have done creative actions. Like I'll have to, if you haven't got my movie Behind Every Terrace There's a Bush, there's a flash movie in it where some guys have this beautiful convertible Rolls Royce, and they're throwing out the deception dollars, and it's really humorous. And so that's one of the creative things that people did with deception dollars. But
I put mine on my refrigerator here in town when I got it, or here at our house.
That's the common thing. I think there's probably more deception dollars on refrigerators than any piece of political art ever.
That's a place of honor in the house, on a refrigerator.
I just hope, you know, the reason we did it was basically to overcome censorship. We couldn't get out any of the information, and most of the information at that time was online. And to just get them to those websites with information besides the regular stuff. I mean, that's what we tried to do.
And it's still going on, right? You're still refining it and updating it and all that?
Yeah, well, every time I think, oh, God, I hope this is the last issue. I mean, I want them impeached. I want them in jail. I want to stop those guys. But and the last one has Cheney on it. It says impeach Cheney first. And with Bush in the background. And I don't know, we always wonder, you know, what's going to happen with the next election. Like in 2004, we didn't know who was going to get elected or selected. So when we realized that the election was stolen, Blaine had made an election deception dollar with Kerry facing Bush. And I printed 500,000 of those in December in hopes of getting out the word about the stolen election and preventing him from taking office in January 2005. But my husband's Canadian, and we always go to Canada for Christmas, so it was just such a tight production schedule that the distribution, unfortunately, didn't happen until I got back from Canada. So we didn't have really enough time. I just barely missed getting them out to everyone before I left the country. So we weren't able to stop him from getting inaugurated. I mean, I don't know whether 500,000 of the election deception dollars distributed in a more timely fashion would have, you know, been able to mobilize enough people to stop that inauguration process back in 2005. But, you know, I just do the best that I can. And I think it really is going to take, I was reading somewhere that somebody was saying, even if we have, I think there's a state senator from Arizona who signed the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth petition and joined them and spoke out in front of them. And I know I've met a state senator, a friend of mine knows a state senator, and we are getting more and more people at that level to speak out on 9/11 Truth, plus just, you know, Ventura, different people. But if you just look mathematically, I don't think a few people in powerful positions who have a greater voice are going to make the difference. What it really needs is lots and lots and lots of ordinary people reaching out to their friends and their communities in order for us mathematically to become a large enough political force to change things in this country. So everyone has to do their bit. No one powerful or several powerful people can do it all.
Mm-hmm.
I think. I don't know. What's your opinion?
My opinion is I agree. I guess it's like selling books in a way. Yeah, I found out that the one person at a time and really meet that person is the only way you really ever do anything. And it would be the same thing with politics, I imagine, that, and we're getting any, you know, an issue like that across is one person at a time, and takes a lot of work, but it's really the way, I think, to do anything.
Yeah. A friend of mine, I bet you know him. Do you know Bruce Gannon from the Global Network Against Weapons in Space?
Well, I don't know him, but I've seen the name on the Internet, and I've heard of him before.
Yeah, he's been working on his issue for a long time, and I remember he's an Air Force brat, and he was converted when he was actually in the military. And he said there's no such thing as fast organizing. There's just slow organizing. And it is. It's like you have a conversation and you're winning over people one person at a time. But sometimes, you know, people... in my early days, when I'd never even heard of the alternative press, when I, you know, was my background, I came from a Republican family, and just, you know, I didn't have a clue what was going on until I was like 34 years old. It was like, whoa, what a shock! One of the first films that I promoted was, Who's Counting Marilyn Waring on Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. And she was the first woman legislator in New Zealand. And in her film, she basically is giving a lecture and talk, and she says, you know, you're going to be able to reach people that I'll never see, that I'll never have any chance to talk to. And I think what she said was so true, because we all have these totally different circles and worlds that we live in. And, you know, there's some circles I don't even bother. I never go there. I know I don't have a chance to reach anybody. But then there's other circles which I can penetrate and where my voice does count. And I need to sort of, I think, sometimes you have to go beyond your comfort zone and explore new avenues and things. But if each person does something, then I think there's hope. And what we just need is more people trying.
How about the impeachment? You were what has to happen, or what is happening? I mean, to actually make that happen. I mean, beyond rallies, is Conyers doing anything? Or I don't really. I guess I'm not up to speed on it.
Well, David Swanson spoke really eloquently here in Oakland, and we had a pretty good crowd recently, and there was also a sort of strategy meeting for activists, and there was suggestion that we launch suits against our Congress people for failing to fulfill their oath of office. And there's a special word for it, and I don't know what it is. I have to find out. But we have, I think Pelosi definitely cut a deal. Conyers is under a lot of pressure. He probably cut a deal as well. There has to be a huge public outcry. The media is sitting on it. They're not even admitting that they understand what impeachment is. I mean, we have to, in some ways, educate the press that impeachment is not rocket science. It's very simple and straightforward. They've obviously committed crimes. That they're certainly impeachable, and we need to start holding hearings. But the press is saying, oh, we'll talk about it after they start hearings. But, you know, you need sometimes the press to, like, push them so that they do the hearings. It's one of those chicken and egg kind of strange things. So we're still applying as much pressure as we can, and I don't know when. I think the Democrats are hoping that they can distract people with the election and not have to deal with impeachment. And I think they're also just afraid, because if there were impeachment hearings, Congress is also so complicit, so they'd have to come up with articles of impeachment that were specific to only Bush and Cheney, that wouldn't also indict most of Congress for going along with the horrific crimes that they have committed against our Constitution, and also the war crimes too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tricky situation.
How is Cindy Sheehan doing?
Well, she's speaking out, and
is her campaign still going?
Oh yeah,
ongoing?
Definitely.
Okay.
She's very active, and the interesting thing is, you know, where people get their information, they'll give you a completely different view of.
Mr. President, I wish to document that you have clearly lost your mind. Ever since the towers fell, you drove our soldiers straight through hell and left a trail of blood and tears behind. Mr. President.
Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance, and that's Tom Chelston. And I really appreciate Tom Chelston. That's from his CD Brick, and I really think that music and art are some of our most powerful tools to wake up the public. So tell me, when you organized your tour, Mike, did you do it on your own or through peace groups? How did you do it?
Excuse me. Yeah, it's just I just get on the internet and I email around the country. I try and find. In the 2007 tour, I had this whole nationwide tour set up just through emails, and you can find groups all over and somehow get started, get a lead, and get it going. And I had an 80-stop tour plan in 2007, and it just didn't. I got as far as Boston, I think people have other better things to do, I guess, sometimes than coming to a book reading. You know, I can brag that I had a reading in New York City, but there was nobody there, you know, and it was kind of like I just got real tired. But I had all these contacts set up in the West too, so I felt bad about not following through with that. So I went back home and I got a couple books together and got just planned it again for another year, and I finally got the whole thing completed. So there was about 40 stops in 2007, and I think there is about 25 this time. And really, it's fun. I mean, I've got an old car, and it's fun because it made it. It wouldn't have been fun if it broke down. But and you meet a lot of cool people, and it's in the country. You know, I had never been to Los Angeles. About everywhere I went, I had never been before. You know, I got to see Dealey Plaza. That was just amazing to me. And I got to, you know, Tucson, and I'd never been to Las Vegas, Los Angeles, San Francisco. I had been to Seattle before, but it was just, you know, it's really cool. And I was able to take a month or take off from work. Actually, I had to quit, and then I had to take a chance to get my job back, which I did. But
what is your job?
I work at, I'm a staff member at a group home for disabled adults. I've been there for about 6 years, I guess.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No. That's it. I was done.
Oh, okay. But so you set up your tour just from the email contacts? Because I do remember I got emails from you, and I was just like totally overwhelmed, and I just you know, everyone generally wants me to organize a speaking engagement for them, and I just, it's like, oh my God, I just can't do everything.
I can imagine when you get to be a contact person, you get it from everyone. Yeah, that's right. It's emails and just keep at it, and that's how you do it. I know. Then you take off and drive.
Uh-huh, and you keep your fingers crossed and hope that it does get set up and it does get organized and that people do.
Yeah, okay. Sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't work out, and sometimes it's great. You know, in Tucson, there was 70 people there, I think. It was a really good, some of them were 9/11 truth groups, and because I would...
Go ahead.
And Iowa Terror is about terror in a small town, and it's about just how we are watching for, you know, everybody but I think who we should be watching. And it's about this Hispanic high school kid, Jesus Iowa, and he is sitting in class, and he's watching his teacher brings the TV into the classroom and watches the towers come down. And he's kind of an architecture enthusiast, and he understands it's a controlled demolition. And he goes through this and that, and he's branded the terrorist because he's Hispanic, and he also has these different views. But through Jesus Iowa and through the narrator, we just have him pursued by all the, I guess, the traditional idiots of a small town. And I just and I don't know, and I try to talk about the Democrats and what they could do, but that's that.
Well, also you have an interesting twist to the ending too. It's like this big, huge, gigantic drama, and then he turns up in a very unexpected place doing something very, very unexpected too. So that's but I know for me personally, you know what, I was amazed too that you got people to review it, like Mark Morford from the and he's, you know, I wish I could win over Mark Morford. But you did.
Maybe my emails, maybe he succumbed to all my emails, I don't know, but yeah, I guess, it was neat. Sometimes you get lucky that way, and that was this time with this book, that was truly the big one. And Maria Heller, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but she also liked it, I guess. She sent up a blurb, and Nicholas Levis, I think is how you say it, from the New York 9/11 Truth Group, and there were 9/11. Pardon me.
Levis,
okay, and there were a lot of different 9/11 Truth Groups that I contacted. They let me send a copy, and some of them sent a blurb. There was from Columbus, Ohio. I think there was one from Maryland, and there was the Dallas Fort Worth Group had me come down and visit with them. Let me see. I mean, there was the Tucson group was outstanding. They had a really well organized thing.
Yeah, and I think a lot depends too on just how timing too. Just simple timing. I know having organized innumerable events. I mean, I've organized events like at the Herbst Theater, where we had a full auditorium. We had to turn 300 people away.
Oh, man.
Then I've also organized, you know, rallies and marches where it's just been me and a few other people. I think a lot of it depends on what the lead time is, what conflicting events are going on, and you know, whether it's raining, whether it's not raining. There's just so many different variables, which, and whether you get the press or you don't get the press, and so forth. So it's you just never know when you're organizing how things are gonna turn out, especially if you do things. Well, depending on the lead time, too. So,
you know, you mentioned you go to Canada. Where do you go in Canada when you go?
Well, my husband is from Montreal, so we usually go to Quebec. We've done this since my firstborn was 2 months old. But his parents had a place on a lake, and they're so old now, they finally sold the place on the lake. So the traditional summer winters with the whole family on the chalet on the lake have ceased, but we still go to Canada every Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the only time I actually don't do my activism, because I actually get a vacation.
Online and on demand, this is We the People Radio Network.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. Were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were pre.
Hello! Welcome back. Hello, welcome back to Question War Organizing Resistance. That was David Rovix. And one of my favorite songs, After the Revolution. And I was just thinking about what you were saying, Mike, about the way you've done outreach and work in the internet. I think you've done it, you know, very, very effectively, and especially with so much persistence. And I think we're so much of the organizing that has happened since 9/11 has happened really grace of the internet. Like when you mispronounce Nick Levice's name, When we first started organizing the 9/11 Truth Alliance, it was a cooperative of different websites, and Nick was on phone calls from Berlin, and Nick organized the first sort of conference on 9/11 in Berlin before I organized the one in San Francisco, and we sort of found each other on the internet. I did the first street action in San Francisco, and when it was posted on the Indie Media site, I got like 400 emails then the next day, and I started communicating with other people, but a lot of the organizing happened online. There were just a few 9/11 websites initially, and now there's just, you know, literally hundreds, if not thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I mentioned to you before that the NSA is working closely. Now they just announced that they wanted to do this Manhattan Project to counter the new cyber terrorist threat. And I can't help thinking of Iowa Terror. how this is just such a mask for, you know, the war on dissent, the war on freedom, that a way to just frighten everybody. That what they're really going to be going after is, you know, the websites which are having powerful ripple effects and getting out truth, not actual cyber terrorists who are going to, you know, destroy the country or whatever.
But that's what they'll say, is that these are terrorist websites and they need to shut them down. I think, yeah, the internet has been such a gift. I don't know however we got it. It's a great thing. I mean, I've been reading websites like Citizens for Legitimate Government and others, Truth Out, for a long, long time, and that's the only place I ever really get any news. I don't read a paper. Maybe it's evident that I don't, but I don't. But I just don't see anything in any hope in newspapers right now. My radio doesn't work in my car, so I don't hear the radio either. But anyway, the internet is outstanding, and there have been a lot of heroes, I think, on the internet that have maintained these websites over all these years. And I think they're they deserve, I don't know what, they deserve some type of an award when this is all over.
I just watched an online video today looking at the firewall in China and how China is cracking down on dissent, and it also looked at the role that Google and Yahoo and all those other giant internet companies had of monitoring what was said and giving the information to authorities so the authorities could go out after people who said things that they shouldn't say and sent them to prison and where they're tortured and killed and so forth. And that, I think that technology and those techniques can also be used here in the United States. That we were lucky in that the internet evolved here, and we have been able to take advantage of the freedom that we found. Just like me with the deception dollars, it's like, okay, when a door slams in your face, you figure out, okay, how do I go around this? And the internet has been, when the only place where you can exercise free speech is where you can't be seen and you can't be heard, what do people do?
I think of when Kennedy was killed. I guess I go back to that a lot, but we, in my small town from Norfolk, Nebraska, we all thought Oswald did it, and there's no way to get an alternative opinion when there's just, you don't get it. The internet has been great that way. I mean, it's just kind of preserve any whatever freedoms we still do have. And there's websites like BartCop, and everybody's got their own favorite websites, but Common Dreams too, and all the 9/11, the 9/11 Truth and 9/11 Blogger and all those. And they've really done a job. What is the next thing with 9/11 Truth? I mean, is it just to keep growing people one by one and trying? Is that what you think is going to, and just what do you think is going to happen with that?
Well, I just got an email from Michael Wolfley, and it's a poll saying, should we do another one of these Week of Truth, and what action should we do? And I think one of the challenges for the 9/11 Truth movement is the fact that it is widespread and diverse, and people don't agree on all the facets about 9/11 or what is the best way to promote it. And also, there are local events, regional events, and it's a lot of money, and it's expensive, and it's difficult for people to all go to New York City and go to Ground Zero, or all go to Washington, D.C., or to gather for a big, huge conference. And everybody has to... I know when we made the dollars, we were like, well, only you can figure out where you can contribute the most, because some people can produce movies, some people can produce radio, some people can write great books, do great art. Everyone has their niche and their abilities and their skills, and we need all sorts of talents, including things like investigative reporters, lawyers, all sorts of things. And I've always hated or been reluctant to say, okay, there should be a national organization that dictates. I mean, who's going to follow?
The one big event, huh?
Yeah. And who's going to, you know, and when you're, when, if you give somebody, I mean, there's some people, you have like activism 101, 202, 303. There's some people who just found out about 9/11 and they don't know what to do. The first thing is generally educate yourself, and then you educate other people. And then there are other actions which require a little bit more chutzpah, courage, which is writing letters to the editor, or writing to your congressperson or your senator, or you know, going, becoming public, making a presentation, giving a talk publicly. Sometimes even just raising this at the dinner table can be just a horrifying experience depending on your family. So there's a whole, you know, huge range of actions which, and I know, and then there's sometimes the situation demands certain actions to, I mean, there's a sort of a natural logic with movements where I know movements go through different stages, and if you can identify what stage the movement's in, then you know which roles are needed, which hat you should wear in order to help the movement go from that stage to the next stage. Looks like we got another break here.
Okay.
But we'll be back in just a few minutes with Mike Palachek.
It's time to think outside the box with your host, Alex Angeli, from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Central every Saturday right here on We the People Radio Network.
There's some distressing information, sir, which I think should be explained. Just which things have been lost and just what has been gained. Like the thousands of put options bought days before the crash. If the money were collected, it'd make quite a pretty stash. And the only stocks they bought were American and United. Deutsche Bank knows the answer, but the names have not been cited. And is it just coincidence that this firm in the private sector was once run by Fuzzy Krongard, now CIA director? And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Estania, or another Reichstag fire?
Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm your host, Carol Rie, and I'm speaking with Mike Palachek, and we were just talking about the 9/11 truth movement and where it is and what it's going to do. And I think what I was hinting at was that we have a lot of skills and talents, and a lot of people are doing a lot of really important work and have specialties, and they should do it. And then some people aren't really sure what to do and need a little bit of direction. So there was an email I just got, and these were ideas that were thrown out in a national phone conference on what the focus of the next, if people organize collectively, week of truth action, what they could be. And one of them was putting bannering on behalf of whistleblowers at federal buildings. And one was a campaign to get C-SPAN to cover the New England 9/11 symposium that's coming up. And one was, I can't understand it, so I'm not going to say it. One was promoting the Reflecting Pools theatrical run. I know that's going to be premiering in New York July 11th, so to promote it in general. And that's a great film, too, which, if you haven't seen it, it looks at using like a novel form, a narrative to draw attention to how challenging it is for an investigative journal to break 9/11 truth in the mainstream media, and what the media does to truth tellers, and it's not pretty. And then there's also to promote the New York City ballot initiative to get a real commission investigating 9/11 on the ballot. And then there's another to support Air America's Month of Truth, which is happening right now. And then another to print out the 14 points of agreement with the official government reports on the World Trade Center destruction paper, which is, of course, finally, Stephen Jones has these raising the big scientific questions about 9/11 in a peer-reviewed journal, which is a big deal, and as a way to begin a dialogue, because since truth will win, if we can just start the dialogue, then we're okay. We'll win the argument. And then the final suggestion here is contacting local fire departments and police departments and educating them about 9/11 truth. So those were the suggestions from the people who participated in the phone conference call. And
how do you get the reflecting pool? Is that available? How? Do you have any idea?
Yeah. Just go to the reflecting pool website, and you can order it there.
Okay.
The DVD is available. You can even get 10 at a time for less to get a volume discount. And it's great. We actually premiered it in Oakland last September, except I shouldn't say that. He said, don't use that word. We gave a special preview last September in Oakland. And the filmmakers were there, and they actually got a lot of feedback from the audience, including a lot of very heavy criticism, because in the San Francisco Bay Area, we have all these hardcore 9/11 activists who know so much about the subject, and they objected to the things in the film that could be used to attack the movement, like the flashes on the pod. So the filmmakers actually changed the film and included more about Building 7, removed the flashes from the pod because of the criticism. So I think it's actually a better, stronger film. And then it premiered in Los Angeles and in Florida in January, and it just got released on DVD not very long ago. But it's one of our great tools. And I also, there's another really interesting artsy film about 9/11, which I think you'd love, but I don't think it's available yet. It's called Able Danger, and it's done in the style of a film noir, very artistically, high production values. And the main character in the film, you might know him. Did you go to Vox Pop in New York?
No, I didn't.
Oh, that's too bad, because Sander Hicks, who wrote a 9/11 book about the whistleblowers and the cover-up, he's actually the main character in the film, although the guy's name is Thomas in the film, and he's not married. He doesn't have a couple, a two-year-old child, and fictitious things happen to him, but it's an interesting merging of reality and fiction in order to get out the 9/11 story in a dramatic way, like you do with Iowa Terror. And I think people experiment. We just don't. There's so many people out there that we need to reach, and I think we need everyone's creative talents and efforts to wake people up, and it's hard to overcome those psychological barriers. This information usually is transformative, so that's why I think people are so resistant to it.
I just think I came to this kind of late, but I think that the 9/11 truth people are just the real patriots. I mean, this is to hang with this thing. This it is not the 9/11 truth movement has not gone away, and that's great. I mean, it's due to people like yourself and all these people, these writers and these activists. And I mean, I just really applaud you guys. I mean, they have really stuck with this, and we just really need this.
Well, I think it's growing too. It's nice that one of the conference calls, I think a new group was starting 9/11 firefighters for 9/11 truth, which is great. And I think what happens too is I've been doing all this research on psychology, and if you have two lines, one of them obviously shorter than the other, and people are in a room with a lot of people, and most of the people say that the long one is shorter than the, or that they choose the wrong one, and most people will lie about what they see before their eyes to go along with the crowd, unless one other person stands up for truth. And if one other person stands up for truth, the numbers change dramatically. So if you're in a crowd of people and you're the only one who speaks up for 9/11 truth, it'll make it, you know, 100 times easier for other people to see the truth, admit the truth, and stand up for truth as well. So it just takes one person. So every single person who's courageous enough to take a stand, you know, can have a huge, powerful effect. And then, of course, actually, before I started working on 9/11 truth, I was working on changing the monetary system, and it only really requires changing the entire belief system of the world. So actually, 9/11 truth is a lot easier than what I was doing before. but a guy called me the other day, and he's like, "Oh, I want to talk about community currencies." And we went for a walk, and he was like, he hadn't looked into 9/11 at all, but he was really sharp. And I thought, my God, this guy is incredibly sharp, incredibly well connected. If he wakes up to 9/11 truth, he can have a huge impact. And I gave him some stuff, and I hope he'll go there. But I think, you know, part of it is this one-on-one slow. If people trust you and they realize that you're not a total nut, you know, and then you give them the basic facts. The basic facts are so well concealed by the mainstream media. Sometimes it's just a matter of just laying out these really simple facts. If you can get past the psychological barriers, the people where they, "I don't want to know, it's too threatening to their reality." They just shut down. The people who say, "I wouldn't believe it even if it was true."
it's hard to imagine for me. I try and think of motive, I just hard to imagine. excuse me. Anybody, George Bush, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, killing that many people and still going about your day. And it's just, I think it's hard to think that anybody would actually do that. I don't, and I guess for white people, it's hard for, you know, for them to think that anybody who looks like them could actually be that evil. I think that's something we have to get past. I mean, it's just something that, it's hard to imagine, and you don't want to, and if you don't have to, I guess you just don't.
Well, I have to thank you. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Mike, but I really appreciate your work and your passion to get out the truth, and your skills, your talent, your persistence, and I hope that next time you do a book tour, I get enough warning that I can actually help more.